This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks making the news yet again. This time, he's suing a branch of the federal government. We go there now on Tactics. Good morning. From trying to slow down, welcome to Tactics, right here on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. You are in the Situation Room right here, right now, and we have a lot to cover today, lots of ground that we must go over. And one of those things, before we get into our top story of the day, is that we have the Secretary of State, Mr. John Merrill. He will be stopping by, hopefully in the second hour. We're looking for that, so around 10 a.m., be sure to be glued to your radio because we're going to have an interview with him. He's running for re-election, and so we're going to discuss some of what he's done as the head of the Department of State here in Alabama and also about his campaign bid that is coming up. But that being said, actually, this is not completely unrelated, and I'll probably be asking him about that, about this story in that interview. Mo Brooks, one of our representatives from the Alabama delegation, he represents the district up around the Huntsville area. And because of that, he has a lot of notoriety here recently because he also sits on one of the committees for science and technology, and there was a whole kerfuffle between him and the global warming scare people that are terrified that we're going to hit some kind of horrible critical mass apocalypse here in the next couple of years if we don't stop driving our cars around. And nonetheless, because of that, he just asked a simple question the other day about the amount of ice in Antarctica, and saying that this guy that was doing a presentation seems to not be presenting the whole picture, and then ask about erosion and if that was a contributing factor. And so that amounted in a whole kerfuffle. We covered that ad nauseum. You can check out the segment that we talked about that on tacticsradio.com or our SoundCloud page. Facebook and Twitter also has that. So if you want to check that out, you can get the more details on that. But today he is back in the news because he has been one of the, I believe, 20 people that have gotten together and jointly filed a suit against the United States Census Bureau. Now, to give you a little bit of context of what's going on here, there was a big brouhaha and a lot of outrage and outcry from the left when the Trump administration announced that they were considering asking if you were an American citizen in the census, asking if you were actually a citizen or if you were here legally, and they crowed about this, were incredibly worried about it, even though this is not an unprecedented thing. It's been done by presidents in the past, including Democrat presidents that have included that in the Census Bureau. And the left proceeded to, as they usually do, lose their minds over something that's fairly trivial and insignificant. But when it comes to this, this actually takes it a step further, and what Mo Brooks has done is he is filing suit against the Census Bureau for saying that they are violating by essentially counting illegal immigrants as residents and counting them as citizens. They are violating the rights of not just Alabamians, but Americans as a whole. And this is kind of a long clip, but he does such a good job of explaining it. I figure I'd let Mo Brooks actually explain it to you in his own words before I get too far into it. This is Mo Brooks the other day from the House of Representatives speaking.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today to defend Alabama citizens' right to fair representation and equal apportionment under the United States Constitution. In some recent censuses, the Census Bureau counted illegal aliens, and indications are they'll count illegal aliens again in the 2020 census. This potentially illegal practice puts Alabama at significant risk of losing a congressional seat when the 2020 census reapportionment occurs for the 2022 elections. For this reason, the state of Alabama and I have filed suit in federal district court for the Northern District of Alabama against the United States Department of Commerce and the Bureau of the Census to require them to exclude illegal aliens when they conduct the 2020 census. Specifically, the state of Alabama and I challenged the legality of the Department of Commerce's residence rule, which counts everyone, including illegal aliens, in America's population count. If the roughly 15 million illegal aliens in America, no one knows for sure how many there are, were dispersed throughout the United States in equal proportion to each state's population, then no state would be disadvantaged in congressional representation, and this discrimination issue would be moot. However, the difference in illegal alien population between states is dramatic. According to Department of Homeland Security 2014 estimates, 46% of America's illegal aliens live in just three states. California, with the greatest concentration of illegal aliens, estimated at 2.9 million, has roughly four more congressmen due to apportionment that counts illegal aliens. Reapportionment of House seats and electoral votes is a zero-sum proposition. One state's gain is another state's loss. With an estimated 65,000 illegal aliens, Alabama citizens and citizens of many other states as well lose proportional representation because of various open borders policies of some states. The exact effect of the illegal alien population on the apportionment of congressmen is complex based on the, quote, method of equal proportions, end quote, formula that is used to minimize the percentage difference in population per congressman. But one thing is clear. Simulations of the apportionment process using current population projections suggest Alabama is at great risk of losing a congressional seat if the Census Bureau counts illegal aliens. As with anything in the United States Constitution, the census should be read, understood, and strictly administered according to its original intent.
Amen.
The 14th Amendment protects the rights of citizens to fair and equal representation. Any deviation in this process threatens the right of each American citizen to fair and equal representation in Congress. We cannot allow a small number of states to cheat the rest of America by promoting illegal immigration and then, as a reward for their lawless conduct, to receive greater proportional representation in Congress and the Electoral College. Mr. Speaker, the question is clear. Should congressional representation be based on the number of American citizens or expanded to include the number of illegal aliens? I cannot speak for anyone else in Washington, D.C., but for me. And as for me, I side with American citizens, not illegal aliens and illegal conduct. America is a republic, and the essence of being a republic is respect for the right of American citizens to equal protection and equal influence over congressional elections. Any attempt by the Census Bureau to undermine American citizens' equal protection and equal influence over congressional elections must be opposed. And that is exactly what the state of Alabama and I are doing by filing this action on behalf of Alabama citizens.
All right, lots to unpack on there, and we're going to get to it in just a second, but we do have to take a commercial break. We're going to get down to what exactly that means and what it's going to look like going forward, and we will do all that on the other side of this break. 860-1440, that is Mo Brooks speaking from the Well of the House.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
You do well to wish to learn our arts and ways of life, and above all, the religion of Jesus Christ. These will make you a greater and happier people than you are. George Washington.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440, that's the way to get in touch with us if you want to do so. You can also tweet at Tactics Radio and get into the program that way. Now, there's a couple of things that we have to talk about here where Mo Brooks, you just heard, a Alabama member of the House of Representatives was just speaking in D.C. talking about how they are suing the federal government, specifically the Census Bureau and the Department of Commerce, because of their actions toward essentially granting what they call residency to non-citizens and counting them as a part of the census, which in turn is then used to decide things like electoral college votes and the amount of representatives that are put forward in the House for Congress. And there's a couple things that's really important to note. First of all, Brooks rightly points out at the end of his speech and very much emphasizes this point that we are a republic. And when you are a republic, the thing that matters most is your representation. Because the whole idea of a republic is that you take the people and you count them up and then you decide representation based on a vote, and then that person represents the interest of the people there. What's funny about this is these people, at least in federal elections, even though I'm sure that there are some that actually do vote, unfortunately, through voter fraud, but even though they are getting representation and they're being counted for that, they're actually not allowed to vote themselves. And so what you have is people that aren't able to vote, that aren't able to cast their vote, that are being represented by other people that voted and got more representation, even though they had less people to earn that representation than people in other states that don't have illegal immigrants, which means that the votes of the people that have areas with very low immigrant populations are actually disproportionately being disenfranchised. You want to talk about not being able to be represented, which the Democrats have been crowing about ever since you talked about voter ID laws? That's what that does. If somebody is voting that shouldn't be, or if somebody, even if they're not voting, is counted for representation and other people in another area are getting extra representation over people that don't have illegal immigrants in their area, then you are debasing the foundation of our style of government, a republic. Because the whole point of a republic is that you have people that represent you and that representation is equal. If it is not equal, then our government no longer functions as it was originally intended. Now, granted, I do get the idea behind wanting to know how many illegal immigrants are in the country. I don't think that that's a problem. What is a problem, because there is some value in having a number and having some idea of how many are here. We still don't know exactly how many. But the problem with that mentality is I'm fine with actually getting the number. I am not okay with them getting that number and then using that as a determining factor in how much representation that area should get in A, the Electoral College, and B, the House of Representatives. You can quickly see why that would be a huge problem, because each illegal that is counted lessens the impact of an actual citizen. If you are counting the representation and you are putting forward members in the House that are supposed to represent people that are not citizens, then you are lessening the impact of that representation by legal citizens. Because a non-citizen is not somebody that should be counted. And this doesn't even necessarily go for illegals. There are several people here that are perfectly legal. They have green cards. They've gone through the process. We know who they are. And I have no problem with those people being here whatsoever. But I do not think that they should be counted if they are non-citizens as residents and using that to determine exactly how much representation they're going to receive. It's nothing against them. I don't think they're bad people. And if they want to be citizens and want to go through that process, by all means, welcome to the country. Happy to have you. But you should not be counted until you are actually a citizen, even if you are a legal resident. Because the country exists for the benefit of the citizen, not the non-citizen. And even if they're living here, even if they're paying taxes, you're supposed to actually become a citizen in order to get that representation. Now, if you're talking about reforming the citizenship process, lowering the bar so that more people can become citizens, I'm open to that argument. I'm open to that discussion. I think it's ridiculously expensive and too intrusive and takes too long as it is. But let's not just say, well, since that process is really hard, let's just grant those rights to everybody. No. That's not how it works. If you have a problem with the system, you correct the system. You don't ignore it. And so that's what we're dealing with right now. Actually, what's funny about all this is that this debate is somewhat reminiscent of a debate that happened very early in our country's infancy. In fact, before we had the Constitution, this was part of the debate. How many people were going to be counted for representation? And that revolved around slavery. That revolved around slaves. The South was making the argument slaves should count as a person because we want more representation in the House. We want the representation in the Electoral College. And because of that, slaves should be counted. And then a lot of the majority of the delegation from the North was saying, well, now, hold on a second. You can't simultaneously claim that they're property and they're people, because you can't own people. They're either people or they're slaves. You have to count them one way or the other. And if you're going to count slaves as part of your representation, then you have to allow them to vote. And the South did not like that idea, and that led to a split that almost ended the Constitution before it began. That's what led to the Three-Fifths Compromise. So what the South was arguing is, well, because it will increase our representation, it'll increase our power in Washington, we want slaves to be counted as actual people. We want them to be counted when we're deciding how many representatives we get in the House. And the North was saying, if we allow that to happen, then slavery is going to continue forever. And so a lot of people will make the case that it was the South that didn't want slaves represented. It's actually the exact opposite. The people in the North did not want slaves counted because they knew if slaves were counted, then slavery was going to last forever. The Three-Fifths Compromise is actually an anti-slavery measure. But nonetheless, this is kind of reminiscent of that. What the people are saying now is, well, we want illegal immigrants to be able to be counted. Now, a lot of those people, unlike that debate, would also like the ability for illegal immigrants to vote as well. But that's... You're having a similar situation where people are making the argument that people should be counted, even though people should be counted to elect officials, even though they are not the ones actually electing them. And so you're having an issue there. But what this all boils down to, this is not a partisan issue. This is not a partisan issue. This is not something that Mo Brooks is doing because he thinks it will help Republicans. So far as I can tell, he's doing it because he believes it's the right thing to do, and he believes that Alabama voters are being disenfranchised unfairly because of this. Because you'll notice he was talking about the three biggest states, and he mentioned specifically California. But you know what the other two states are? Texas and Arizona. They get extra representation, too. They're Republican states. Those are red states. In fact, counting illegal immigrants may help Republicans more than Democrats. I don't know. I'd have to look it up. But the point is, this is not a partisan issue. This is about right and wrong and whether or not citizens should be represented or everybody that just happens to live in the area, whether they're here legally or not, should be represented. That's what this question boils down to. So props to Mo Brooks for doing this. Democrats know this is a stepping stone to amnesty, calling residents and having some official capacity. That's why they're pushing for it. But I don't. Take it, Rush.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
James 1:25. But one who looks intently at the perfect law, the law of liberty, and abides by it, not having become a forgetful hearer, but an effectual doer, this man will be blessed in what he does.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, those are the numbers if you want to call in and get in touch with me. We've got John Merrill on in, it looks like, about 30 minutes. So right at the top of the hour at 10 o'clock, we should be there with the Secretary of State. He will be here in studio to give a interview, and we're very much looking forward to that. There was a high school out in East New Jersey. It's called Cherry Hill High School East, which came out and officially apologized for their prom tickets. And as you can imagine, it was because somebody got offended at something that was on there. But here's what was going on. They were offended because it had on the tickets, "We're going to party like it's 1776. And the reason that this phrase was on here is because this was in, you know, it's in New Jersey, and it was going to be at the National Constitution Center, which is why they said, hey, we're going to party like it's 1776. Now, personally, I am offended. I am deeply, deeply offended that a high school saw this and went ahead and approved it, despite the fact that the Constitution did not exist in 1776. They're thinking of the Declaration of Independence. The Constitution was not ratified until 1789. And so I too am offended. I understand this. I get why people were offended at this. They should have apologized. They should have apologized for getting the date wrong. But that's not why they were apologizing. They were upset because, according to this, this is a statement from Principal Dennis Perry, quote, "It was insensitive and irresponsible not to appreciate that all communities can celebrate what life was like in 1776. I especially apologize to our African-American students, whom I have let down by not initially recognizing the inappropriateness of this wording." Here's one of the big issues that I have with this entire thing going forward. This principal did not let down any African-American students. Were things awesome for African-Americans in 1776? It was for some of them, not for a lot of them, because of what's happening and what he's talking about here is slavery, I assume. But the idea that things weren't always awesome for every community in this particular time period, that's what made it insensitive. Look, celebrating a time period is not celebrating everything that happened during that time period. And we'll get to that in just a second. But the school freaked out about this. They issued commemorative tickets with a new design that dropped that. But if this is the problem, if this is true, then every single theme party that has ever been done is offensive. Toga parties, for example. The Greeks were not great on human rights. In fact, the Greeks did some pretty horrible things. They kept women in the temples that they built to their pagan gods as prostitutes for men to go in and consummate with so that they could, they saw that as a form of worship to certain gods and goddesses. Children's sacrifice was something that was rampant in the paganistic world back then. So if that's true, then all toga parties are offensive. You can't do toga parties anymore. Hawaiians actually had slaves. So any Hawaiian theme parties, any luaus, anything like that, that's something that needs to be done away with immediately. In the 60s, there were things that were going on in the 60s in society that were not great. Of course, we have the civil rights movement. There were people being hosed down in our own city just to the north of us of Birmingham, civil rights being violated left and right. The 70s, there's the war in Vietnam. Some horrible things took place there. Occasionally, because of the Americans, usually because of America's enemies taking action against us in most of those cases. So, I mean, any of the decades parties, any party that's themed with a certain culture. I know, for example, when it came to my fraternity, one thing that we did is we did pirate theme parties. Just because we were celebrating and dressed like pirates in movies and on Disney rides and whatnot does not mean that we were advocating for theft and rape. Same thing with Vikings. The Minnesota Vikings are not celebrating the culture of pillaging and rape that Vikings did. They just think it's a cool mascot and that they were great warriors. And because of that, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to pump the team up with the symbol of something to emulate. They're not celebrating every single aspect of this. And this is really the problem that we have. I really do think, and this just goes to further my point, there are people that constantly walk around seeking things to be offended by. And when it comes to 1776, you know, anybody would acknowledge that things were not great in 1776 for black people, but things weren't great for American citizens either, mainly because there were no American citizens before July 4th of that year. People were being quartered, having soldiers quartered in their house, having people spy on them, having their goods taken. There were a lot of terrible things that happened in 1776. But everybody, including the black community, fared better once the country got going and the Constitution started. That was the beginning to the road to end slavery. Didn't mean everything was perfect right away. It took a really long time for us to move on and took an even longer time for us to get to where black people were truly given their rights and treated as equal citizens under the law. But My point in all this is celebrating that particular time period and celebrating the good things that happened there does not mean you're wholesale endorsing everything that went on. And it also ignores the fact that we had quite a few black founders that were part of the revolution that did fight in the war to help, and not because they were compelled to, because they desired to. Some were compelled to. But a lot of them believed in fighting for this particular cause. And when it comes to this, celebrating a time period is not a celebration of everything that happened. You don't do a Mexican theme party because you're celebrating child sacrifice by the Mayans. That's not, if you're doing like a fiesta themed party, that is not the goal of that party, to celebrate child sacrifice by the native people of Mexico. Nobody goes to Oktoberfest as a celebration of the Holocaust. That's not why you go to Oktoberfest. You go to Oktoberfest to eat some German food and drink some German craft beer. That's what Oktoberfest is. It has nothing to do with celebrating everything that has ever happened in Germany. That's not saying that everything that ever happened in Germany is awesome. And so people have gotten just so ridiculously overly sensitive when it comes to this whole thing. Saying that we're going to party like it's 1776 is not saying, oh, and by the way, we want black people to come and show up dressed as slaves. That's ridiculous. That's not the part of 1776 that they're celebrating. And now we're getting to the point to where you can't celebrate anything if there's anything mildly offensive put together with it. I'm all in favor of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Got no problems with it at all. He was a great man, great leader, somebody that a lot of people could look up to, had a lot of the right ideas. But he was not a perfect person either. And so if you're going to play this game, you can find something offensive or something wrong with everything that is potential to be celebrated. There is nothing that is not offensive if this is the new standard that we're going to. There was a day when you would hear somebody complaining about things like this, and you just told people to get over it. Say, look, this was not the intent. Nobody here is out to get you. Nobody picked this party theme, or nobody picked this particular venue because they were seeking to offend somebody or they were trying to be insensitive. And so just, you know, get over it. That comes with giving people at least a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, that you assume because somebody is doing something, they're not doing so to go after you, they're not doing so to attack you. Giving people the benefit of the doubt and treating people with love, with respect, that is going to be how we're going to get out of this, because now we've gotten to the point to where whoever has the lowest threshold of offense gets to ruin it for everybody else. Gets to say to everybody else, no, you can't do this. And that's not the intent here. I don't think people should go around intentionally offending people for no reason. I don't think that you should go around to stick it in people's face. For example, and I know that there are going to be some folks upset with me for saying this, there were some people back in my high school that would wear the rebel flag, and they did so because they thought of it as part of their Southern heritage, Southern pride. There were also some people who wore it and would carry it around strictly because they were racist and didn't like black people. But see, unfortunately, what happened is we vilified the symbol, not the person. The vast majority of the people that wore that symbol were people that were just Southern rednecks, good old boys that wanted to, you know, show their Southern heritage, show their Southern pride, didn't have anything against anybody. You had other people that intentionally did want to stick it in their face and do it just because they could say they did it. Those were the extreme minority. But because of that, because we're vilifying the symbol, we're vilifying the thing itself, not vilifying the intent or the evil malice that has risen up in people, I have a hard time believing a bunch of New Jersey high school kids put this on the ticket because they wanted to stick it to black people. Primarily because there's probably not that many black people that go to their high school, considering they're in New Jersey. I mean, maybe some, but not nearly as much as you would see here in the South. But I really doubt that that was the intent, and I don't think that anyone was like, we're going to put that on there because, you know, slavery was back in 1776 and the country was a better place back then because of slavery. I don't think that anybody thought that. If someone did think it, okay, then that's a problem. But we always assume the worst in people, and I think that's the reason that it's so easy for people to get offended nowadays, is when they see something that could be even somewhat mildly interpreted as being offensive, they assume the absolute worst. They assume the person is a racist or a sexist or is out to get them or hates them. And because of that, that causes a lot of problems that really would not be there if we all just took a step back and tried to assume the best in people, tried to assume that people are actually wanting to do the right thing, that they actually do care about other people and other people's feelings. And because of this, because we have essentially deferred to whoever has the lowest threshold of offense, we've ruined it for everybody else. Because if this is something that is offensive and no longer appropriate as a theme for a party or a school dance like it is in this case, then there are no themes that are acceptable. 860-1440, we'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The best friend to American liberty, who is the most sincere and active in promoting true and undefiled religion, and who sets himself with the greatest firmness to bear down profanity and immorality of every kind. John Witherspoon, signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440, that's the way to get in touch with me if you're inclined to do so. And speaking of the phones, we're actually going to go to the phones right now. We've got Ben on line one. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Caleb. Hey, I just wanted to comment on what you were talking about. Back when I was in high school in the 70s, mm-hmm. we could wear pretty much what we wanted on our T-shirts. You know, let's say peace symbols or little marijuana plants. You know, it didn't mean we were hippies and potheads, you know.
Right.
And as long as it wasn't offensive, you know, we knew. No one, you know, went nuts over it. But today, the political correctness back then wasn't as crazy as it is today. Today, it's like a mental illness or a disorder. The liberals of that time were hippies back in the 60s and potheads, and they're the same ones now complaining about the stuff that they used to condone back then.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny turnabout, because you had these same guys in the 60s and the 70s, these politicians that were at Woodstock and everything else, that were saying that, hey, what we need to do is free speech. Free speech is awesome. People shouldn't tell people what to say or what to think. And then as soon as they're the ones in charge, they're the ones in power, all of a sudden, no, it's okay that the government tells people what to think.
Exactly, and led by George Soros and Bernie Sanders and the rest of these. They, you know, Sanders and them were hippies back then, too. I guarantee he was.
Oh, the Clintons were, too.
But, you know, the political correctness and all has gotten just out of hand. It really has.
Yeah, it has, and I think that that's really a shame, because I've always been a big fan of free speech. I've always been someone that was an advocate of that, and unfortunately, what we've got now is people that are trying to control what you think, trying to say you can say this, you cannot say that. And what we've really got, unfortunately, is a situation where we have the thought police. Now, I do think that you should be held accountable for your speech. I do think that you have to deal with any of the consequences of your speech. But I don't think that you should be able to say to anybody, okay, you're not allowed to say that. And speaking of consequences of their speech, there is a story out today about the Pope, who has commented on something, and a lot of people are going crazy over this. This story is continuing to gain steam and get bigger. So to give you a little bit of context, there was a sexual abuse scandal going on for years in Chile, and just recently all 34 of the bishops in Chile have resigned. And Pope Francis has met with one of the victims named Juan Carlos Cruz. And in an interview with CNN, this is the original source of this, he claimed that the Pope told him, quote, "You know, Juan Carlos, that does not matter. God made you like this. God loves you like this. The Pope loves you like this, and you should love yourself and not worry about what other people say." Now, this is, of course, in regards to the man being a homosexual, which, if that is the case, this runs completely contrary to biblical teaching on not only sexuality, but also sin. That the Bible does teach that God loves you regardless, but it doesn't mean that you shouldn't worry about it or that you shouldn't care about what other people say about it. In fact, the Bible says often that we are supposed to care about our reputation, that we're supposed to live above reproach. However, I do want to say this, and I want to emphasize this as well, commenting on what the Pope is saying here. it is important to keep in mind, this is secondhand information. This is not a direct quote from the Pope. We do not have a recording of it. We don't know for sure that this is what he said or this is how he said it. We're getting this secondhand information from a person that said, this is what the Pope said to me about homosexuality. So there's a few possibilities here. One possibility is this is a pretty accurate representation of what Pope Francis said to him, which if it is, this is a very, very far departure from Catholic doctrine, Catholic teaching on the on homosexuality and sexuality in general. And so if that's the case, that really is big news. The other option, another possibility for the reason this is shaking out, is that this is a pretty accurate representation of what Pope Francis said, but there's some kind of context or some part of the conversation that we're missing that was omitted by this guy. So maybe he said right before then, look, God loves you, don't care, you shouldn't care about what other people say, but you do need to get out of your sinful lifestyle. It's possible the Pope said that. We don't know. So it could be that in the proper context and with the full conversation, it would shed some light on the Pope's actual intent on saying this. And then there is also the third option, which is this is a complete misrepresentation by this guy. As somebody who's a minister myself, I can tell you that there are times where people, especially with religious figures, they really only hear what they want to hear. And because of that, this could theoretically be a case of this, that the Pope either mistakenly gave him the wrong impression or he took the wrong impression intentionally because that's what he wanted to believe. And so all of these are options. I'm not going to throw the Pope under the bus. I mean, the Pope says a lot of things that I disagree with. I think that he's overly socialist in some of his leanings, and I think that in part comes from his background and where he's from. But nonetheless, on this, I do think that we have to hold judgment until we find out what was actually said. I do think it's a little odd that the Pope has not commented on this. I do think it's strange that the Pope, if this is completely contrary to what he believes, and especially as big a story as this has become now, that nobody has that nobody from the Vatican has thought to come out and say, look, the Pope didn't really say this. This is what he actually said. This is what he actually meant, so on and so forth. But to my knowledge, I have not yet seen the Vatican issue an official statement on this. And, you know, we'll keep an eye on that. We'll try to let you know if that takes place. But if this is what the Pope actually said or what he meant, I think would be incredibly problematic for Catholics.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Secretary of State John Merrill joins me in studio now on Tactics.
Just try your best. Try everything you can. And don't you worry what they tell themselves. You're away. It just takes some time. A little girl in a little hot the ride. Everything will be just fine. Everything will be alright, alright.
Hey. Welcome back to the Situation Room. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the way to get in touch with us. You can also tweet at Tactics Radio, be a part of the program that way. And we have in studio right now John Merrill, the Secretary of State, and we're very excited to have him. He's running, of course, for another term as our Secretary of State, so good morning.
Good morning, Caleb. How are you?
I'm doing good, and I will try not to call you John McMillan this time.
That's all right.
Because you remember last time we did an interview,
I
did
that as a compliment. He's a great man and has done a tremendous job as our agriculture commissioner.
Can we take that as an endorsement of him as treasurer?
Well, I'm endorsing myself in my race for Secretary of State. I'm not getting in anybody else's race. He is a good friend, though.
Fair enough. I actually interviewed him last week, and yeah, he is a good guy. But Secretary of State John Merrill with us today, and I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things. And by the way, if you do want to ask him a question, call in 860-1440, tweet us at Tactics Radio. We'll try to ask that question if we get time to get to it. But I had to ask about this because I think a lot of people, I know I'm not the only one because I actually talked to other people in political circles
sure.
that were surprised about this. kind of surprised that you didn't run for governor. A lot of people were expecting that. So why Secretary of State, not governor?
Well, as you know, Caleb, from the conversations that we've had before, I wanted to be the Secretary of State since I was 14 years old. And I had a lot of success as a member of the legislature in working toward passing legislation that helped our election system, helped our voting system, and also just made it easier for people to be able to do what they want to do in the state of Alabama without encumbrances. Now, when I became the secretary, one of the things that we felt like we had to do was to modernize the office, make it more efficient and more effective. And that's what we've worked to do for the last 3 years and 5 months and 4 days that I've had the privilege to be your Secretary of State. We want to continue to do that. We know that we've done a lot. People say you've been an outstanding Secretary of State, but what we want them to say when my time is up is we want them to say that he's the best Secretary of State Alabama has ever had. And we didn't have a learning curve when we started, which is one of the reasons why we were able to get so much done so quickly. And we've done a lot, but we've got more to do. Now, I'm very flattered and very encouraged when people say or have said or say today, we want you to run for governor. You should have run for governor. We want you to be the governor. And that means a lot to me. We have a governor, and I think she's doing an outstanding job. We have three candidates that are running for governor that are all fine men, that are all good friends of mine. So the people have quality choices on the Republican side to be the next governor of Alabama. But I just felt like with what we had done and what we hope to do, we need some more time to continue to make the office what it should be and what it needs to be for the people of Alabama. And the best way for me to do that is to fulfill my commitment for this term and then to run for another term and let us make that happen.
Well, now I do find that encouraging that you already have good relationships with all of the people running for governor on the Republican side. So I think that that would be a big boon for you, that there's not going to be infighting or anything like that, any friction between the office of governor and the Secretary of State.
Well, Governor Ivey has been very supportive of us and what we've attempted to do. We've worked with her and her team since she became the governor on April the 10th, 2017. We want to continue to have that relationship with her. I did not know Mayor Battle until 2012 when I first started campaigning for Secretary of State. We became fast friends. Senator Hightower and I served together from the time that he joined the legislature after Ben Brooks took a position as the circuit court judge in Mobile County after his election there. And he did a great job for those citizens and decided to offer himself after his first full term in the Senate for governor. And I did not know Scott Dawson. I knew of Scott. I knew of his reputation, and I knew of his faith and all of the outstanding things he'd done in the evangelical community, but did not know him until he started running. So we become friends now.
Well, now, I wanted to talk to you about this, speaking of elections. I don't know if you've heard the news this morning. It just broke yesterday, I believe. Mo Brooks actually going and talking about the census, counting different people, illegals, people that are legally here but not actually citizens, as part of the representation in the House, as part of the representation for the Electoral College. And so because of that, and because there's an Alabama congressman speaking about this, and the studies that he's showing, the research that he's shown, actually shows that that hurts us and costs us about one representative vote in the House. So what's your take on that?
Well, there's no doubt that it hurts us. I made a presentation about this in Baldwin County last week to a number of constituents that attended a program that they asked me to coordinate down there in Orange Beach. And what our goal, as far as the census is concerned, is the same goal that we have in registering folks to vote, which I know you'll want to talk about in a few minutes. But that's to ensure that each and every eligible U.S. citizen that's a resident of Alabama is registered to vote and has a photo ID. We think that the people that need to be counted for the census are people who are United States citizens who reside in that state, not people who are here illegally, not people who are here because they're on a temporary visa, not people who are here on a green card, but people who are citizens of the United States need to be counted for that state. Alabama has continued to grow. Our population has continued to increase, but not at the same rate of some of these other states that have allowed illegals to come in and to take benefits from our citizens and others who are here. That's not right, and it's not fair.
No, it's not. And I've said this to you in the past when we were actually talking about voter ID laws and voter registration, that every vote that is counted, in this case, it's not even a vote. It's just being a resident. But every vote that is counted is in some way taking away some of the weight of the people that are actually supposed to vote, actual citizens. And so that devalues our rights.
No doubt about it. And that's the reason why we have to make sure that we're giving Governor Ivey our full support as she moves her team toward considering how they're going to try to implement the census in Alabama to ensure that our citizens are fully counted and adequately represented when that census is taken.
All right, so we're going to actually take a quick early break because I have a couple things that I want to ask the Secretary of State. We'll try to get your phone calls in just a second, but what I want to ask about is the special Senate election, because I know there was a lot of controversy surrounding that, so we want to go ahead and break that down and ask his take on that. That is coming up in just a moment.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 1:21, "For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain."
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. Not sure what just happened with our technology. I think Satan must have possessed it because he doesn't want the word of God getting out there. Added some static. But nonetheless, we are back and we have Secretary of State John Merrill in studio with me right now. And we've got him for another couple of segments. One thing that I wanted to ask you about, because this is the most recent election, and it's the one that had a great deal of controversy because it was so close. And I know that in the case of Roy Moore, he actually said after the election, it's not over yet. We're still hoping that to trigger an automatic recount. And he did some fundraising to try to fund a recount himself. So if you would kind of give us a play-by-play on how your department handled that and exactly what you did to ensure that the votes were counted correctly.
Sure. Well, Caleb, primarily, we just followed the law as established.
That's a novel concept.
Well, it is. It's not something that you always see in Montgomery, but it is something that we do, and it's something that we know is important to our people in the state, that they are comfortable with the process and know that it has integrity and credibility. I think the thing that's probably of the most interest to you and to your listeners are the number of irregularities that were seemingly reported and the number of concerns that people had about the process and what actually happened. Now, one of the things that we established when I became Secretary of State, we did this in March of 2015, is we established the Alabama electoral integrity process with the ALEA and with the Attorney General's office. Mm-hmm. With this Alabama Election Fairness Project, it gave people the opportunity to report things that they observed or that they encountered in the electoral system that they may be uncomfortable with. And so we actually received 125 unique instances of fraudulent activity or irregularities that were reported in that U.S. Senate race alone. Mm-hmm. We examined all of those, and to date, I think all but about 10 of those have been completely adjudicated. Now, the four that were of primary concern and interest really dealt with individual issues, so I'll talk about those for just a second if you'll let me.
Sure, go
ahead.
First
and foremost, we had a situation that was reported where there were five bus loads of African Americans that were bused into Alabama under the cover of darkness to participate in our electoral process, and they allegedly came from Mississippi. Upon further examination of the video evidence that was presented, mm-hmm. what we discovered was these five bus loads of African Americans were all part of a football game that was going on in Mobile at that particular time. Had nothing to do with the election. The sequence of the video didn't even come from that particular period of time. It just came from when it was filmed. It was earlier in that season, and it was dark. The second one was about three van loads of Mexicans that were brought in here from some other state, were allowed to vote, and then later were arrested and incarcerated. The only problem with that was there's absolutely no record of any illegal votes being cast in any one of our counties that would be related to mm-hmm. Mexican citizenry participation or having any of those individuals incarcerated in any one of the 67 counties on the 11th, 12th, or 13th of December 2017. Number three, allegedly there was a community about 20 miles south of Birmingham called Bordalama. And in Bordalama, there are about 2,200 citizens, but 5,000 plus people actually voted in the election in Bordalama on that particular day. The only problems with that particular situation that was reported is that, number one, those votes are not reported by municipality or community. They're all reported to us by county. Mm-hmm. Number two, there's nobody 20 miles south of Birmingham in either Jefferson or Shelby County that has ever heard of a community or municipality named Bordalama in the history of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So that was all fabricated, but it didn't stop Facebook from continuing to promote it or perpetuate it, and it didn't stop Twitter either.
Well, unfortunately, social media is where conspiracy theories thrive. So
no doubt about it. And last but not least was the one that really concerned me the most as we were moving forward, and that was when a young man who was very supportive of Doug Jones and who was very encouraged to participate in the elections process, mm-hmm. was interviewed by a reporter from Fox 10 in Mobile, Katie Weiss, as she was doing their spot reporting that night. She went up to him for the person on the street interview and said, "Would you tell me why you're here and what this means to you?" And he said, "Well, we all came here from different states. We all came here and canvassed for Doug Jones. Then we all voted for Doug Jones, and we got our boy elected, Doug Jones, and started bouncing around the room like a bunny rabbit."
Right.
Now, the thing that was interesting about that was Katie threw it back to the studio at Fox 10.
Mm.
About 3 days after the election was over is when I started getting this video coming in. So I called Katie, and I said, "Katie, after the interview was over, did you talk to the young man and ask him what he meant by a statement?" She said, "No." And so I talked to the producer of the news at Fox 10, talked to the managing editor, talked to two other reporters, and they had no concept about how to try to reach this guy. So I talked to Doug Jones' campaign manager, talked to his volunteer coordinator, and a couple of other people in the campaign. Nobody had ever seen him before. Nobody knew anything about him. So as I was continuing to do stories about this at the state and national level, I just asked the reporters as they asked me to pursue this or what we were going to do to pursue it, "Would you please put a link to this story on your story if you run it? And if you print it, just try to put a link in your electronic version and encourage people, if they know him, to contact our office." About 3 days after that happened, so it's almost a week after the election, I got a call from a young man that I used to teach in Sunday school when he was growing up. I've known him since he was born. He lives in Birmingham now, but he grew up in Tuscaloosa.
Right.
And I asked him what he knew, and he said, "I know the boy, and I've got his cell phone number." And so we were able to reach out to him, find out what he meant, what was going on, and this is what we discovered. He was from New York. He had lived in New Jersey for a while. 2 years ago, he moved to Alabama in the Venture for America program and was working in a private business in Birmingham, had an apartment that he was living in, came here, got registered to vote, found the Doug Jones campaign interesting, volunteered for the Doug Jones campaign, voted for the candidate, Doug Jones, and was as legitimate a voter as you or me or Cassidy.
Yeah, well, I mean, if he's been living here, then yeah,
absolutely.
He's a legitimate voter just like any of us.
But that still doesn't stop people from sharing right. that video, but that's the facts of the matter.
All right. Well, I mean, it sounds like you've done your homework on all of those, and which I know the voters of Alabama really appreciate, because as far as that goes, there were a lot of people that were really worried about that there was some kind of voter fraud. Look, you may not like the results of the election, but the election was done fairly. Let's go to the calls. Take a couple questions for some callers. Let's go to John from Millbrook on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, Mr. Secretary, I wanted to ask you a question about this. This is more of a general question in that I know you're going to be a leader in the future with the conservatives and being a Republican, that kind of thing. And one of the mantras that's placed on conservatives like you and I is that we're white people, we're all racist and that kind of thing. And how are we going to overcome that description that is so often given of us and is depicted on so much of the media and that kind of thing? I mean, how would you react to that as we move forward? Because we're going to have to get beyond that at some point.
Well, that's a great question. I'll tell you, when I first became the nominee for the Republican Party back in 2014, my first meeting with Secretary Bennett in his office, first time I had ever been in the office of the Secretary of State, I asked him, I said, when's the last time there was an African-American that was working in the executive office here, in the office of the secretary? And he said, I really don't have any idea. And come to find out, it had been more than a decade. And we actually hired a young lady. She does all of our publications. She does all of our resolutions. She does a lot of our printing of our printed material, conceptualizing it as well as developing it and making sure that it's done what it should be done in the end. And her name is Brittany Hamilton. This is the first job she's ever had, and she is the first person you see when you walk in our office. We also had another person that we actually moved to the executive office because we felt like we needed more of a presence in the executive office for people because there were only two people that were physically working in there. Now we have four. So when you come in, no matter if somebody's on the phone or not, you're going to be able to be helped by someone. So we moved another person down there. Subsequently, that individual has been relocated. But I say all that to say this. We had more African-American division heads. We had more African-American employees that were promoted, and we had more African-American leaders and hires in our office than at any other time by any other secretary in the last 50 years. So we're excited about that because let me tell you this. I think this is real important for your listeners to know, Caleb.
Sure.
I would not hire somebody because they're black, and I don't hire somebody or promote them because they're black or white. We want to make sure that we hire the most qualified person and that we promote the most qualified person, regardless of your ethnic background or the pigmentation of your skin. That's not important to us.
I was going to say, I can't speak for every district or every voting precinct, but I know I live up in Millbrook, and we go down to the community center, the civic center, I forget what its actual name is, to vote. And every time I've been in there, I think I've only seen one white person actually working the polls, and I don't care. It doesn't bother me one bit. They've always been very friendly, very fast, and I appreciate some of the work your department has done on this. Even though it's secure and I have to show my ID, it's a very quick process. You go in, you sign, they check your name off the list, you vote, and then you walk out.
Right.
But as far as that goes, it is, to me, really laughable when people, especially in the past couple of years, and I know you and I have personally talked about this before, when they say that the voter ID laws and the ones that were put forward and implemented by your department are racist and they're disenfranchising black people, I'm like, there's nothing but black people working the polls in my particular district.
Well, and Caleb, look, let me say this. You know, people are entitled to their own opinion.
Sure.
But they're not entitled to their own facts.
Amen.
So what are the facts? The facts are that since January the 19th, 2015, which again is 3 years, 5 months, and 4 days ago, we've registered 980,963 new voters in Alabama. We now have 3,377,815 registered voters in Alabama. Those numbers are unprecedented and unparalleled in the history of the state. We also have broken every record for participation in the history of the state in the last three elections that we've had, which are the primary election for president, March 1, 2016, with 1.25 million people, November 8, 2016, with 2.1 million people going to the polls in the general election for president, and then in the special election for the U.S. Senate on December 12th of last year, we had 1.3 million people go to the polls. And not one time has anybody been denied access to the franchise because they did not have an ID to present at the polls those days. All we're trying to do is make it easy to vote and hard to cheat.
Yeah, and that's exactly the standard that it should be. And I did think that it was really funny, especially in the special election that you just mentioned back in December of last year, that Doug Jones' campaign and the media were crediting the black vote for handing him the victory, which if you look at the numbers, there's a lot of truth to that. But what's hilarious about that is, like, wait a second, you were the same people that a year ago were saying that black people can't vote in Alabama.
That's exactly
so,
right.
So, like, you're
that's
contradicting
exactly right.
yourself.
And, you know, we had some protesters that were at the Capitol Monday of this week, and one of the things that they were talking about was passing laws for felon disenfranchisement. And the last law that was passed when Mike Hubbard was serving as a speaker, and the last law that passed under his leadership as Speaker of the House was the felon disenfranchisement law, which for restitution and restoration of your voting rights if you paid all your fees and fines associated with your original sentence and you've served all your time associated with your original sentence, then as soon as you're done, you're automatically restored to receive your voting rights.
Which I think is fair. I mean, once you've paid your debt to society, you ought to be reinstated the other rights that you've been afforded. But I did want to ask you real quick about this one. Well, I'll tell you what. I don't usually do this, but we're going to go ahead and just take a break right now, and I'll have you back for one more segment.
Yes, sir.
Because I really want to get your opinion
Absolutely.
On this. All right, that is John Merrill, the Secretary of State. He's running for office again, seeking re-election, looking for your vote. We'll be right back, 860-1440.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
I am a Christian in the only sense in which he wished anyone to be, sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others, Thomas Jefferson.
All right, I am going to have to work on this computer. I don't know what is going on this morning with the sound, but nonetheless, we are back and we will soldier on. We are here with Secretary of State John Merrill. He is in here for an interview. He's going to be running for another term, so he's asking for your vote here. And Mr. Secretary, I did want to ask you about this because it's something that I don't tend to really, and I think a lot of millennials are in the same place that I am, I don't tend to really recognize myself as either a Republican or a Democrat. I tend to vote with the Republicans when it comes to primaries, and I appreciate that our state doesn't require you to register. We still have open primaries here. But I was thinking about it, and this would actually allow them to close the primary. Where do you stand on the issue? What would your opinion be on maybe defunding the primaries and having the Republican and the Democrat Party or the Libertarian Party or whatever other party wants to host their own primaries, fund it themselves, and then, of course, the Department of State would take care of just the general elections?
Sure. You know, that happens in other states, Caleb, and I really think that if the legislature made that change, and if there were no longer an opportunity for the people to vote in the Republican primary or the Democrat primary, it would probably end up changing the entire paradigm of the election. Because one of the things that people think today is, well, the election is going to be decided in many instances on June the 5th. And that's because when the nominees are selected, there may not be anybody running in the general election against that nominee. But people are so used to voting then that if it went the direction that you're talking about, what would really be beneficial to the parties if it went that direction would just simply be to have a convention or a caucus and not have to hold elections. In that sense, nobody would go to the polls. Then all the people that were elected by the parties would come together and they would determine who their nominees are from the state to the county to the local level where there are assignments made when people run in partisan elections at the local level. And then those individuals would be the ones that would be selected as the party nominees. And I don't think that the people of Alabama would respond very well to that just because they would feel like a small group of people would be determining who their leaders would be.
If that was the outcome that it resulted in, I agree with you that that would be a problem. But personally, I don't think that the parties would do that just because their members and the people that are registered, because, of course, we would probably go to registering Republicans and Democrats if we moved to that system. I don't think that they would be real happy with that system. And because of that, I think that the membership of the Republican and the Democrat parties would step in and say, no, we're actually going to have elections. We're going to host primaries.
Well, and you may be right, except that one of the things that happens today that would not happen in the scenario you described is the involvement of county election officials. Poll workers would have to be determined by the parties. They'd have to be trained by the parties, certified by the parties. When all of those things happened and the costs that are associated with the elections, considering that in each election cycle, for a primary, for a runoff, and for a general, it's costing you about $5.5 million per time, then your average cost of an election is going to be around $16.5 million. When that happens, the parties, as we know it today, the state Democrat Party and the state Republican Party, they don't have the resources in order to pay for the election cost that would be associated with them administering the election on their own. So there's a lot of things to think about when it comes to changing the process.
Oh, yeah, this is not a simple issue.
Yeah, and not that it's not something that needs to be done, but it's certainly something that requires more than just a general conversation.
Right, and one thing, though, that I would say about that, and I agree that that would be an issue, is that that does cost quite a bit in resources to be able to host a primary.
No doubt.
But in a certain way, you could also make the argument, shouldn't that be an argument for them hosting the primaries themselves, because that would save the state a lot of money?
It would, because when you look at what just happened with the U.S. Senate special election,
right,
we have an inordinate amount of resources that were actually spent on that race that a lot of people were disappointed that we had to have in the first place.
Right.
Of course, Governor Bentley made the decision not to call the special election early.
Mm.
And when Governor Ivey came in, we already had the paperwork prepared for her to show her, A, how much it would cost, B, what the time frame was, and C, what would happen each day that she waited. So as soon as she came in, within a couple of weeks, she called the election for August, and then the runoff, of course, was in September, and the general was December the 12th.
Well, I certainly appreciate your office doing that, because otherwise we would be getting much less return for the investment that we put into it, because whoever we elected as the senator would have been the senator for a shorter amount of time. Now, in retrospect, I think a lot of people, knowing how the election turned out, would a lot rather have Luther Strange actually stayed in there. But nonetheless, I do appreciate that you conveyed to the governor, look, if we're going to do this, we need to go ahead and do it now. But anyway, that being said, I wanted to ask about the 2016 election real quick, and I don't want to rehash it, but just real quickly, because I know that this has been an issue and the Democrats continue to beat this drum nationally, at least when it comes to your department in the state of Alabama, is it true that Russia did try to hack into our voting system?
It's a great question, Caleb. One of the things that your listeners need to know is that we have people that attempt to violate our system every day. They try to hack into our system. We've never had our system compromised, and we're very proud of that. We work with our public and private partners to ensure the integrity and the credibility of our voter rolls. Mm-hmm. It would be extraordinarily difficult to try to hack into an election through the equipment that is at the polling site, where each person goes, takes their ballot, puts their ballot in the machine, and then has their vote counted. Because they're not air-linked, they're all individual. You'd have to go in and try to reprogram each one of them individually in order to make that happen.
So in other words, this isn't something that somebody can do from Moscow on a computer. They would have to actually physically come here with agents, go into the voting booths themselves, or the voting areas, and hack the individual voting machines to get the count wrong.
That's correct. And those voting machines are kept under lock and key until the day that they're placed in the polling location for the election to occur. I think something else that your listeners need to know is that in February, I had the privilege to have a personal audience with Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, and we talked about the 2016 election for the presidency. And she assured us that there were absolutely no tabulation changes that occurred in any state in the union in the 2016 election cycle. Also had classified briefing from Homeland Security, from the FBI, from the Central Intelligence Agency, and from counterintelligence, where we heard reports about some of the things that did happen, some of the things that they were able to interrupt, and it put me in a much more comfortable position than I had been in before.
Mm-hmm.
I also think it's important for your listeners to know that the threat is real and it will continue. Primarily, what the Russians and other foreign and domestic actors have tried to do in order to influence our position is to use social media, either through Twitter, through Facebook, through other social media sources, Instagram, whatever it is that they can use to encourage you to feel certain ways about certain issues, or to cause you to ask certain questions about certain issues, and to actually cause chaos and confusion. One of the examples that was given to us, and this example is not classified any longer, so I can share it, but there was a foreign actor who actually planned a pro-Trump rally in New York at a particular time on a particular day in the election cycle, which was about 10 days before the election in 2016. At the very same time, that same group of people had planned an anti-Trump rally in New York on another side of town. It's the same people putting it together just to cause chaos and confusion.
Well, and I read about that story, and that goes along with what I've been saying about that election for a very long time, which is the Russians were not, at least so far as I can tell, actively pulling for one side or the other. They were trying to create distrust in the system more than anything.
No doubt.
All right. But thank you so much for being here, Mr. Secretary.
Yes.
Always appreciate your time. If somebody has heard what you're saying, they like what you say, they want to support your campaign, how do they do that?
Oh, Caleb, look, they can send a check to Friends of John Merrill, P.O. Box 2117, Tuscaloosa, 35403. They can go to our website at johnhmerrill.com. But even more than that, let me share this. If someone wants to talk to us about issues that are important to them, they feel like they've got something that they need to share with us, they're welcome to call me on my cell phone anytime at 334-328-2787, because I work for the people of Alabama, and I will be doing that regardless of what happens in the election until January the 14th, 2019. And I want your listeners to know they can reach me directly on my cell phone if there's something that they feel like I need to talk to them about personally.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Secretary of State John Merrill running for another term. He will be in the primary June 5th. Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Caleb.
Yes, sir. We will be back with the chaplain's report in just a moment.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 3:20. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that's the number if you want to get in touch with us, want to talk to us about that. But we do have the Chaplain's Report coming up right now. We have that ready for you to close out your day, get you ready since it is the middle of the week. Got to finish out the week. Malachi 4, 1 through 3, the prophet Malachi writes, "For behold, the day is coming, burning like a furnace, and all the arrogant and every evildoer will be chaff. The day that is coming will set them ablaze, says the Lord of hosts, so that it will leave them neither root nor branch. But you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with the healing of its wings, and you will go forth and skip about like the calves of the stall. You will tread down the wicked, for they will be ashes under the soles of your feet on the day which I am preparing, says the Lord of hosts." So a couple things to let you know about real quickly there. The Lord of Hosts is typically used as a name for God that is almost always associated with his really status as a in war. In other words, the armies of the Lord, the when he would go and help Israel win a battle, win a war, he was referred to as the Lord of Hosts. And so this is language that is coming forward with the idea that God is going to visit justice and make war with the evil people of the world. That's what he's talking about here. And another thing where he talks about the evildoers being like chaff. For those of you who are unaware, chaff is essentially the leftovers after you've sifted wheat. After you've gotten the grain, after you've gotten the good stuff out of the wheat, everything else that is not edible, that is not good for food, that has no use is known as chaff. And the chaff has no use other than just being burned. And because of that, you see this tie-in in these verses talking about the evil being burned as chaff, and that the day is coming when they will be set ablaze. In other words, God's fire is going to bring down judgment on those who do evil. But those who fear the Lord, it says, those who fear the name of the Lord, righteousness will shine on them, and they will skip about as calves of the stall, and evil will be as ashes under their feet. So you see that connection there? That he was just talking about chaff, just talking about evil burning, and then when he talks about the righteous, the evil is going to be the ashes under their feet. The evil has been burned. The good does triumph over the evil. And so a couple things to notice about this, these few verses. You cannot stop the day. It's like a storm. You can prepare for it, you can be ready for it, But you cannot stop it. The day of judgment is coming. God's time where he will judge the nations is coming. And a lot of people speculate that part of what Malachi was talking about is the days of Christ, when the evil would burn, and eventually in 70 AD, Jerusalem burned as well, unfortunately. But the only way to be ready for this day, the only way to be ready for God's judgment on any day when it comes, is to fear God. That's what Malachi is saying. And ironically, it is funny that the people who need to fear God the most, the ones that are in danger of being destroyed by God's judgment, are the ones that are not afraid. Ironically, the ones that ought to be the most afraid are the ones that are not afraid at all. And it really is a testament to their foolishness. But God's judgment creates a very distinct contrast here. You can either fear God and be granted freedom, or you cannot fear God and be granted destruction. There is no middle option. There is no riding the fence. There's no, well, I kind of feel like I'm religious, I'm spiritual, but not religious. And God and I have an understanding, and you know, God's all right, but I don't want to get too far involved. That's not the picture that is given here by Malachi. You are either with God's people or you are not with God's people. And those that are not will be destroyed. The wicked are burned like chaff. You see, God is a loving father, and that's part of his personality that the Bible describes, and it's accurate. But we should not forget that he is also a judge and an avenger. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.